You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Well, settle in for this week's MLB.com Extras, National League Central Edition, where you're going to hear about celebrations in Chicago, injuries in Cincinnati, pitching in Pittsburgh, resilience in St. Louis, and trade posturing in Milwaukee. All that and more. MLB.com Extras, National League Central Edition, with Jen Langosch. And Jen, last week, oh boy, all we asked was that somebody make it a little more interesting, because as we pointed out, all the Cardinals do is win. Doesn't seem to matter who's on the field, who's healthy, who's not healthy. And we got a little drama right out of the gate. So let's just start by apologizing. And let me ask you, how's holiday doing?
Yeah, you know, I wish I had as much power to have control over these things. But yes, you know, we taped Monday afternoon, and a few hours later, we watched Matt Holliday go down with a quad injury. The good news, you know, the Cardinal fans have become quite, you know, routine. These routines, the quad things have been routine here. Same as we saw with Tommy Pham in spring training. We saw with Matt Adams in May, now with Matt Holliday. The good news is this isn't nearly as severe as Matt Adams's, which requires surgery, as everybody knows. So the Cardinals don't have necessarily a timetable just yet as to when Matt would return. But, you know, there seems to be a feeling that maybe mid-July, shortly after the All-Star break, could actually be realistic. So given that it's a grade 2 strain, given where it is in his quad, there's no need for surgery. So it's one of those with just rest and treatment. It should heal on its own. But, you know, certainly as that time frame becomes a little clearer, I think at that point then the Cardinals decide if they need to go look elsewhere for some outfield help, or if they feel like they have enough right now. And, you know, to this point, they did have a glut of outfielders, and they were looking for opportunities to get each of them on the field. So this, you know, unfortunately created that sort of opportunity. It gives a guy like Randall Grichuk and even Peter Board just a little more opportunity for exposure.
Yeah, there you go. Silver lining. I like it, Jen. You know, and it has been the case. You're right. With a lot of bodies, and most teams, I think, get this. I mean, all teams get this. I don't know the fans always do, but we talk about it when we get to the end of spring training. The reality is, whoever makes that 25-man roster, great, but they're probably not just going to use those 25 guys all year. And depth is a huge, huge factor as you traverse the summer. And the Cardinals have shown to have plenty of that. Now, that said, you know, you never like to see somebody like Matt Holliday go down. You don't like to see guys like Lance Lynn go to the disabled list either. What's the latest with him?
Yeah, I mean, the team does have an all-star team on the DL, it seems like. The news on Lance Lynn is very positive. You know, of everybody that's on the DL, his stint should be the shortest. You know, he's pitched through this forearm tightness, as it's described, for most of the year. Now, it got worse in his most recent start in L.A. just over a week ago, and he believed that was because of some of the long innings that he had in that game. But, you know, this is something that both he and the Cardinals said he probably could have kept pitching through, but, you know, with an opportunity to unplug him for 2 weeks, essentially only missed two starts. They kind of wanted to give him an opportunity to get that inflammation out of there and just let it calm down a little bit, with the hope that then he'd be able to pitch through the rest of the season without issue. So, you know, we're already a week plus into his DL stint, so I would expect next week when the Cardinals are in Miami that we'll see Lance Lynn back on the mound. And again, that accounts for just two missing starts. And, you know, for the first one, Tyler Lyon stepped in and did just fine, and he'll get another opportunity later this week to try to do so again. So that's probably the best injury news that I've had for you in a while.
Yeah. No, that's definitely, again, a positive, you know, more silver linings to otherwise cloudy skies, at least for individuals. As we mentioned at the top, Cardinals have really not struggled. They have not missed a beat, no matter, it seems, who it is that goes down. There's been strong starting pitching all year. We've talked a lot about that. And I'm sure it's a, you know, a lot of teams, a lot of good teams, that the bullpen doesn't always get their just due. This bullpen, though, for the Cardinals, has been just as good as that starting rotation. Maybe better, I don't know. And you could argue that the month they're putting together right now, I don't know, is it borderline historic what they've been doing?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I don't think we've given them enough credit. I mean, you look at, now we're halfway through June right now, and this bullpen has allowed one earned run over, you know, the first 15 days of this month. So, you know, what they're doing is pretty remarkable, too, when you consider that they lost their eighth-inning setup guy, Jordan Walden, at the end of April to another injury. So, you know, essentially they had, kind of a hole in the eighth inning for much of the month of May that they were trying to fill. Kevin Seagrass has stepped up, and the Kevin Seagrass who are watching pitch now is very much the Kevin Seagrass we saw in 2013 when he was healthy and, you know, just really shocked everybody with his effectiveness coming up from the minors. So he's kind of climbed into that eighth inning setup role. Trevor Rosenthal continues to be lights out in the ninth inning, leads the league with 21 saves and 22 opportunities. And, you know, as good as he was last year in his numbers, you know, at the end of the year were very, very good. This year there's been very little dramatics. And guys are not getting on base. His walk rate has decreased. He's getting the first batter out with great efficiency, unlike last year. So if this game gets to the eighth and ninth inning, well, and you know, record-wise, the Cardinals haven't lost a game this year in which they've led after the seventh inning. So, and then the supporting cast with Matt Belisle and Carlos Villanueva and Mitch Harris, you know, Jeff Maness. This is a group that maybe doesn't have flashy names that are known all over the league, but they are getting the job done. And with the good starting pitching combined with this bullpen, you know, it's been able to kind of hold together a team where the offense hasn't gotten a lot of traction to this point. They're winning a lot of close games. They're winning a lot of low-scoring games. You know, and I think at this point we have to throw small sample size out the window. We're more than 62 games into this year. You know, this is a bullpen that's going to be formidable, I think, moving forward.
Yeah, no, there's no question, and there's no question that this team is built for the long haul, and a lot of that goes to the depth we're talking about. And you know, you throw a lot of names out there just talking about the bullpen, but the way they've been able to do it, you know, sometimes guys who aren't as well known as you say around the league or around the country. It seems like something that the Cardinals have done really well in recent years and largely through their own development and the draft. And we had the draft a little over a week ago now. And, you know, once again, the Cardinals doing what they do best. They've already signed. What have they already signed their first rounder? Where are they with the draft?
Yeah, they've already come to agreement with their first-round pick, Nick Plummer, who is a high school outfielder. You know, it's interesting for the Cardinals. You look at their recent draft history, and they've gone very college pitcher-heavy in the early rounds. You know, you think of a Michael Wacha and a Marco Gonzalez, you know, for examples of that. But this year, they went a little bit different route. So they went with an athletic high school outfielder, Nick Plummer, again, who is already signed. It's foregoing an opportunity to go play baseball at the University of Kentucky to start his pro career. And you know, when you look at kind of how the Cardinals navigated through the draft this year, and it was, you know, the first year under a new scouting director, Chris Correa, they did things a little differently. They didn't go after as much pitching. It was the fewest pitchers they've taken in a draft since the draft went down to 40 rounds a couple years ago. They took a lot of catchers, which I think, I know, you know, kind of speaks to what they feel is a lack of catching depth in this organization. So they went heavy in that regard. And they also took a lot of chances on some high school players with some very firm commitments to different universities. You know, even as late as the 20-something and 30-something rounds, guys who maybe would have been top 3, 4, 5 round draft picks that fell just because of signability concerns the Cardinals took. So, you know, certainly they're not going to sign all of those guys. Maybe they don't sign any of them. But their approach was, you know, if we can sign one or two top round talents as a 20th, 30th round pick, that's certainly a coup for the organization. So they've gotten, again, a number of their top 10 round guys already signed, getting ready to go off to affiliates. And then it'll be interesting to see if some of these high schoolers come into the fold over the next couple of weeks.
That's one of the changes that I really love to the draft and to this, the amateur-turned-pro side of the game now is with all the tinkering that's been done in the last, I don't know, 5, 10 years, we see these guys not just getting drafted, but signed, getting out, playing, developing a lot quicker. I think it's certainly been great for the game.
Yeah, and it's been very important for this organization. I mean, you look at the last couple of years, you know, Michael Wacha signs. We see him make his major league debut less than a year later. You know, the following year, Marco Gonzalez was drafted. He gets signed. He goes out to play. A year later, he's making his debut. So, you know, the fact that the Cardinals can get some of these top talented guys signed, get them into the organization, get them a couple months of playing in the minors. You know, they have an opportunity to go to instructional league, and then they start next spring, you know, a little bit higher, maybe wherever they start a double A or a, you know, high level A because they played the year before. So, you know, I think there has been a huge benefit to moving up that signing deadline. You know, probably 5 years ago, it was mid-August. Now it's mid-July. And it does. It gets these players out. It gets them started. It takes some of that uncertainty away. And again, with a team like the Cardinals who rely so heavily on drafting and developing players, it's paid big dividends over the last couple of years. Some of the guys who have accelerated their climb through the minor league system.
No doubt. No doubt, Jen. And I look at your schedule now. A lot of games against the Twins here coming up, but then road Phillies and then the Marlins, then a little home stretch. I tell you what, things are pretty good into the All-Star break. This team cruising along and Man, must be a lot of fun. And how about no drama this week? I can't believe we're asking for this. 1 week later, we're a little gun-shy. But no drama this week, Jen. Next week, we'll just talk a little baseball, a lot of healthy baseball, maybe.
Yeah, let's go back to being boring, Dave. That's okay, I think, with Cardinal Nation.
A couple weeks ago, was on the gritty streets of Chicago giving us a live report. Last time we talked was dodging tractors, giving us a report from the road. And now, Carrie, just off, maybe, in fact, right in the middle of the great celebrations of the Blackhawks victory and the Stanley Cup. Carrie, what is going on in Chicago these days?
Actually, I'm sort of hiding so I don't get run over by all the Blackhawks fans, all the new Blackhawks fans. So it was Mother Nature intervened and perfectly timed. The Cubs were to play the Indians on Monday, and instead we had a lot of rain, so all the Cub fans could go home and celebrate and watch the Blackhawks. And Wrigleyville was quite the party town Monday night. Then it's probably just as well that the Cubs got rained out, because otherwise it would have been just a mess in terms of the people. Now I'm hoping that maybe they'll bring the Cup over to Wrigley sometime soon. So.
Oh, yeah. You know that they will eventually. But what a, there's nothing like a winner in a great city like Chicago. That's a lot of fun. And the Cubs have been winning, playing great baseball. And now the news that they are bringing up their top hitting prospect, Kyle Schwarber, for this short stretch, right? Just a little interleague time as a DH.
Right.
But I think the move itself is interesting to me, Carrie, because to me it just signals something a little more, right? That there are no limits right now to what the Cubs will do this season to win games. Am I reading too much into it?
Well, no, that's correct. I think the other thing is, if you look at their roster, if Jorge Soler was healthy, I think they would have maybe some different options to go with at the DH spot. But Soler's on the DL with the left ankle sprain, so that kind of limits them a little bit. And they played two games in Detroit and used Miguel Montero and Mike Baxter as the DHs, and that just didn't do it. Schwarber can hit. There's been no doubt about that. I mean, the kid is number one draft pick for the Cubs in 2014, and then in his first pro season, he goes out there and hits .344 at three different levels. And then this year at AA, he's hitting .320 with 13 homers and 10 doubles, and he hasn't stopped. You know, what Schwarber, though, wants everybody to understand is that he really wants to be a catcher. He doesn't want to just be known as a hitter. So maybe on the one hand, yay, I'm coming up to the big leagues for six games. On the other hand, you know, I really want to catch, kind of thing. So I'd be curious to hear his take on this. Yeah, they want to win. We'd talked to Madden about possibly bringing up Schwarber before the Tiger series, and he'd sort of went along with it, and then he told us later that he was just playing along with us when we were asking the questions, and maybe it wasn't that serious. So I'm not exactly sure what changed, except, like I say, there aren't that many other options for them, and hopefully the kid can have some fun.
Yeah, well, it's got to be a great thrill anyway, and I think Cubs fans, I'm certain Cubs fans are very excited about the news, and it should be a real fun week to see how it plays out. But it's also, to me, Carrie, it's just more evidence of this great move that the game made several years ago when they accelerated the signing deadline after the draft. And now we see guys like Kyle Schwarber, you know, matriculate to the big leagues as quickly as he has. We see that though the draft is barely a week old, he and a half, the first round pick by the Cubs has already signed. And on the one hand, it's just nice to get these guys, you know, in the loop, get them signed and get rid of that waiting game nonsense that we used to have to deal with. But on the other hand, I mean, it just puts them that much closer to helping the big club sooner.
Yeah, I know last year with Schwarber, he really, he had made it very clear, and he knew the Cubs were interested, and then probably the same thing with Ian Happ. They know that the Cubs are pursuing them. They know that if they sign quickly, it's also a good message to the players, that the players see that know, if you sign, hey, maybe there's a chance that you can get called up quickly. So so this is probably a good message through the whole system and to all the young men who were selected, you know, just June 8th. It wasn't that long ago, was it? Yeah.
No, I mean, we're a matter of days removed, and we're seeing all these first-rounders signing. Of course, and then the Cubs have some of their guys still playing in the College World Series, which is really fun. And one thing that's also just stayed true to form is this team continues to play not just well and win games, Barry, but my goodness, they're heart stoppers. It seems like every single night we see Starlin Castro with a couple of walk-offs. Do you think sometimes that is a like a sign of something bigger? Is sometimes a lot of those types of wins, do they add up to more than simply that one victory that day?
Well, I know, I'm not going to answer that. I know that I've seen the opposite happen. That when a team blows games like that, I've seen that with the Cubs, not this year, obviously, but a couple of years ago when they were really struggling with the closer situation, I know how deflating that can be. So especially for some of these guys who were here during that period, to suddenly have the tables turned and to be coming through in the clutch the way Castro has done, and others as well, but Castro especially, it's been nice to see that, is, yes, incredibly, it's just a huge confidence boost. And it just, Madden keeps talking about how they need to win those kind of games to, as he says, get to the promised land. They need to show that they can win those kind of games, and they need to show that they're not upset, or not cashing it in certain situations, and that he's really encouraged by this. And I know there's a, what do they call it, a trickle down effect. If the manager sees how great this is and then gets everybody prepared, and then Castro delivers, and the next guy thinks, okay, I can come through too. So hopefully it pays off.
Yeah, well, is are you seeing from Joe Madden any more willingness, let's say, than earlier in the year to discuss the potential postseason, the hopes for this team? Has he been consistent all year long? I know recently you talked about hardening this group a little bit, in preparation of the postseason. How guarded is he about his optimism? How much is he pushing that, the idea that this team is prepared for a postseason?
Well, one of the things he's made clear is that he's making moves so that the players recognize that the team is the most important. For example, Hector Rondon is in the game, who is supposed to be the closer, is in the game, walks a batter, boom, he pulls Rondon and has somebody come in and get the save, because he didn't want to lose that game. And Rondon understood the move. And Rondon's the type of guy that he's not going to sulk about that. He knows he's been kind of trying to get his feel back. The other day, Wada was struggling in a start, and Madden pulled him quickly after three innings and went with someone else, and I think it was Travis Wood, and boom, they were able to hang on and win that game. And so Madden said that, I guess, again, his message to the team is, this is not about you, this is about us, kind of thing. And these are the kind of moves that I might be making, so you have to be okay with this now. I just find it interesting, for example, Sunday night, the Cubs were on national television against the Reds, and their bullpen was pretty beat up. And he was telling us that if it hadn't worked out, Travis Wood was going to be his next pitcher. If they can continue to play extra innings, he tells us that he was looking at the outfield to try and see which next position player was going to come in and pitch. So, I mean, he's trying to think ahead, which is good. But it's also, it's been interesting to watch. And it's, I think, in talking to Rondon after he got pulled, he understood what happened, and he knows what he has to do to get back on track. Cubs also have a pretty good bullpen set up where they can afford to do that. They've got Jason Mott, Rondon, Pedro Strop, they can insert any of those guys into the for a save situation and they'll be good. So it's all a matter of conditioning. It's all a matter. It's been interesting that like last year we heard the message was development. Now it seems it's a little more. Like you said, the message is more, you know, let's compete. Let's see if we can win this thing.
Yeah, a lot of fun, a lot of excitement. And then, of course, highlighted by the Kyle Schwarber call-up beginning, well, now to this interleague run. Well, Kerry, always fun. Stay out of trouble. Stay out of the mix there on the streets of Chicago with all the celebrating going on. And
keeping my eyes out for the cup. We're kind of hoping that, like I say, that it'll stop by Wrigley again. So it's always fun.
I like the idea of you doing next week's podcast with your arm around Lord Stanley's cup.
That's not going to happen, I don't think. So by then it'll be with one of the players, and they'll be, who knows what they'll be doing with it. I don't think I want to know, but yeah, it'll be gone. But I think it's good for the Cubs players though to see this, to see how the city reacts to a championship. I think that's really good. You know, you can start to imagine what it would be like if they won. I mean, it'd be like 100 times more party. But I think this is a good experience for them.
Yeah, it's almost frightening to think what would happen if they were to win. But we all kind of look forward to it.
We'll find out.
With Tom Singer, and Tom, this is just an incredible team. And we've talked about it since the start of the season. There are a lot of great pieces here. This is a team that can be very competitive and upset a lot of apple carts. Lately, what we have seen from the Pirates, though, is borderline unreal. I'm just looking back here. What is it, 5 shutouts now in the last 8 games? Do I have that right? This pitching is beyond, I think, what anyone could possibly expect.
Absolutely. 5 in the last 8 and 4 in the last 5, really. The location just has been phenomenal. I mean, you know, they're approaching historical standards. We try to figure out Francisco Cervelli has caught 42 consecutive scoreless innings, and which is the best that the Pirates could find on the team record. But, you know, we're thinking it may be an all-time record, because unless guys like Drysdale and Hershiser, when they set the shutout record, unless they had a personal catcher, which I don't believe they did, I don't know if any catcher has ever caught 5 consecutive shutouts, which is what it would take to top the 42 straight shutout innings Cervelli has going, because 2 of those games were extra innings, the 13-inning and 11-inning 1-0 wins over Philadelphia. He caught all of those games. So, I mean, Cervelli obviously is a major component, as any battery mate would be, but the rotation specifically, and obviously backed up by very solid work from the relievers, the Pirates' ERA for the whole season, and obviously they started off kind of rough, is at 2.79, and we keep hearing that it's still second best to the Cardinals, which is true, but I think it's a lot more significant that 2.79 figure is more than a run below the league average. I mean, that should be your reference point. So it's just been remarkable.
It really has, and that's a good point on the team ERA. It's funny because, you know, the pitching has been so good, and it's really covered up what has been an inconsistent, if not at times lackluster, offense, which kind of makes, you know, the win the other day kind of interesting with Liriano out there winning an 11-0 game, and the Pirates scored 5 runs in the first inning. He, of all guys, right, might be the one guy who's sort of unaccustomed to having that kind of run support.
Well, you know, he and Burnett have taken turns in that role. In fact, I think it's the most amazing stat of the season so far, in my belief. We're talking about Burnett now, not even Liriano, who had received 5 runs total in his previous 3 starts before getting 5 in the first, in his later start. But Burnett's ERA in his 6 wins is 2.79, which is very good. But his ERA in the 7 losses and no decisions is 0.79. I mean, that's ridiculous. So he's had some run support issues too. But that set of stats just kind of blows my mind. But, yeah, I mean, prior to the big blowout behind Liriano, the Pirates had scored 10 runs in their previous seven games, and they won five of them, thanks to that pitching.
Yeah, that in itself is fascinating too. But one of the changes we've seen, at least in this last week, was the move of Starling Marte to the second spot in the lineup, and that really seems to have worked specifically for him. But then, of course, if you want to take an 11-0 game into account, I guess you could say it's working for the whole group. But that move is really kind of making Clint Hurdle look like a genius.
Yeah, the first four games, he put together three hit games and one four hit game. That's an interesting dynamic. The reason he did that, Polanco was batting leadoff, and then he liked to have the two speedsters atop the lineup in front of McCutcheon. Harrison's batted leadoff a couple of those games, but Marte stayed in the number two spot. So the original combination that the Hurdle was looking for isn't really the sole reason why Marte has been productive in the number two spot, because he's done it behind Harrison as well. It's kind of interesting because he was leading off most of last season. It wasn't a good situation for his aggressive batting approach. They kind of moved in the middle of the lineup, looking at him as a run producer type, and now he's kind of very close to the top again, batting number two. But it's really clicked for him. We'll see how long he can keep it up. But he's not going to get three hits every game. But so far, he has.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, I don't know. Maybe he will. Are you a lineup science kind of guy? Do you, believe that the order of individuals in a lineup can can really make a large impact? I know there's some schools of thought that think that every hitter and every result is independent of one another. Where do you fall on this one?
It's always a combination of, who do you have back-to-back, how they complement each other. A good example is one reason Hurdle batted Walker cleanup for much of the season behind McCutcheon, because he figured that obviously Walker's a lot better hitter from the left side. And with McCutcheon batting in front of him, in the late-game situation, he couldn't perceive the opposition going to a right-handed reliever against McCutcheon, with Walker being on deck. So it kind of, strategy came into a play. And, Walker still bats cleanup quite a bit. But, and of course, right now they're in a situation where for the first time all season they're seeing a sequence of left-handed pitchers. And that plays a part in the fact that Jung Ho Kang has batted cleanup, against the left-handers, Hamels on Sunday, and Monday against the White Sox, Rodan. He's produced. So I think the whole lineup composition doesn't depend so much on individual assets as how they complement each other. And I do think the one thing the Pirates have always lacked since I've been covering them is that consistent fulcrum. That cleanup hitter that is in that spot every day. They've tried a lot of different people. Gong is only the latest. They had, as I said, Walker in there. They've even tried Marte a couple of times in cleanup right before he went to the number two spot. And obviously, the whole cleanup experiment goes back to Pedro Alvarez, who would be the ideal guy in that spot with his power, but he just never has taken to it. So other than the fact that you do lack one of the lineup staples in having a regular cleanup hitter, Hurdle effectively moves people around and tries to maximize, the offensive production. And, passing, going down the line, that's his favorite expression, kind of passing the baton from one guy to the other. And so far, he's used a lot of combinations that have worked well, but has never really settled on a everyday set.
Yeah, well, changing directions just a little bit. We're a little over a week removed from the draft, and it's cool to see. To me, and I mention this to folks all the time, I love the fact that the baseball has put an emphasis, with some of the changes in recent years, to getting guys signed after the draft and getting them developed, getting them going. And sure enough, Pirates right there in lockstep. They've already signed their first rounder, young man. is on his way to Class A Virginia, and I'm sure for Kevin Newman, the guy we're talking about, it's kind of an exciting time for him. But I love seeing these guys drafted and then quickly signed and often developing.
Yeah, and they pretty much, I don't know if the club has announced it yet, but they've also signed another first liner, the compensation pick, Hayes. He's in town. He may be introduced later on Tuesday. But yeah, I mean, that's the way the Hurdle puts it, it's such a major transition for these guys from college or maybe, obviously high school to be in a professional environment. And Newman was just all bug-eyed yesterday being on the field as the part for taking batting practice after he signed his contract. So, I mean, these guys have a lot of big steps to look forward to, but that first one when they come into the major league clubhouse and they sign a contract and look around, that's the first steps on the yellow brick road. Once again, to quote Ken Hurdle,
the yellow brick road. Yep, and what a road it's been lately. A lot of fun for the big club and for these youngsters joining the ranks now as well. Plenty of excitement out there in Pittsburgh. Well, Tom, great stuff as always. We look forward to doing it again next week and seeing how much closer the Pirates may be to St. Louis when we reconvene. Have a great week.
That's a point we should make, Dave, real quick. Since January 1, the Cardinals and the Pirates have had the same game result every single day when they both played. So there hasn't been any change in the games behind Colin, which is pretty remarkable.
Don't look now, Adam, but the Brewers, they might not be making up a lot of ground, still 19 games out of first place in the division, but they have won or split each of their last three series, as you and I speak. They're in the middle of a series with the Kansas City Royals, but maybe at long last, starting to get their legs underneath them.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point you can take the standings and sort of burn them because they're kind of irrelevant here. It's better baseball. Mostly it's better pitching that's gotten them going. The bullpen has been really spectacular for this Brewers team and Craig Counsell. And the starting pitching has been okay. Matt Garza has gotten going since coming into emergency relief in a 17-inning game. They've gotten some nice call-ups of performances from guys who came up from the minor league. The one guy, Kyle Loesch, he is having a terrible season. And he struggled again in the opener against the Royals on Monday night. 5 runs in 5 innings. His ERA is just shy of 6.5. It's a big deal for the Brewers, not just because he's their opening day starter, and if they're going to win any games, they're going to need something from him. He's also at the very top of the list of guys you'd look at to deal if you get into that mode in July, and right now his value is pretty much nothing. So they really badly need to figure out how to get him going. And, I asked Craig Counsell, what are the options? And Counsell said the option is Kyle. In other words, you keep putting him out there every fifth day. They don't feel like he's very far off. It's a pitch or two that's killing him each time. Home runs are killing him. You keep running him out there, and you hope that he's able, as veterans sometimes do, to find something and put a couple of good starts together, and the Brewers then hope to get some good value for him. And for Loesch, he could go pitch in a contending situation for the rest of this year.
And this still may be, let's face it, we've seen it plenty of times. There may be a handful of teams lining up, despite the bad numbers and the rough go this year, willing to take a flyer on him. Somebody with a little experience like that, a little savvy, can still help a team down the stretch. But no doubt they would like to see him pitch a little bit better heading into the deadline. The guy I would ask you about, because I think last week when we spoke, Taylor Youngman was about to make his big league debut. He has pitched twice since we spoke. What have you seen? What do you make of big Taylor Youngman?
Well, a couple of things stand out. Number one, his debut was sensational. 7 innings against the Pirates, 1 run in a victory. It was the second time the Brewers called up a guy for a major league debut that he gave him 7 innings. Before that, they hadn't had a pitcher do that in his first start since way back in 97. When Steve Woodard pitched a famous game against Roger Clemens, a 1-0 game, I believe at County Stadium, that sort of was one of those games that stands out if you're someone who kind of grew up around this team. So it had been a really long time, and they got 2 promising starts in a row. He's got poise, which isn't surprising for a guy who came out of University of Texas, a big-time program, as a big-time pitcher, a Dick Houser Award winner. pitching the College World Series. You know, he's been on some reasonably big stages before, so it wasn't surprising that he's pretty calm out there. Just from an eyeball standpoint, you're struck by the way he pitches. This crossbody delivery is as dramatic as you see, you know, really like this side of Jared Weaver. He stands on the third base side of the mound as a right-handed pitcher, and then he steps even further toward third base on the mound. And at Miller Park the other night in his first home game, you could see the spot where his spikes were contacting the mound. It really stood out as something different from anything else that you see. So it's uncomfortable for hitters to see someone throwing that way because there are a few guys who do it. So, you know, good stuff. He had to grind through that home debut, but he kept the Brewers in the game. He happened to run against a guy named Max Scherzer, who was a broken bat hit away from throwing a no-hitter and really, you know, had perfect game-type stuff that afternoon. But two pretty promising starts, and it's clear, you know, Craig Counsell said, they're going to keep putting him out there. He's got an opportunity now to sort of gain a foothold in this rotation for the long term.
Yeah, so that's huge news, a real positive for Brewers fans. Maybe a negative right now is you know, Carlos Gomez taking a little time here. Right leg soreness, which is, you know, normally we hear specific items when somebody goes down for a little bit. And I don't know, this could just be a couple of days. But what exactly are we talking about with Carlos Gomez?
Well, really, they're being general because he's banged up in it's a general area. It's really a hip flexor. So you think of that as more the outside of the hip. But Gomez says it's bothered him over the course of the last number of weeks to the point where it feels like a groin strain. So in other words, it's kind of the front of his leg, and it's different areas of that leg are bothering him at different times. They tried to knock it out by giving him a couple of days off. He came back, and it bugged him again, so they bumped him from that opener against the Royals on Monday night. We'll see how much he plays this week. Craig Counsell says it's because they want to get, you know, 100 good games. There's just less than 100 games left for this Brewers team, and they want him to be good through the end, and they feel like taking a couple of days now is what it takes to get the good games later. Again, there's a bigger picture here, just like with Loesch. Carlos Gomez is another guy that would be a really nice trade chip for this Brewers team. He's been a top 20 MVP player the last couple of years. He is signed for this year and next at salaries under $10 million, which in today's game is all right for a player of his caliber who can do something at the top of a lineup for a team. So, you know, having him healthy and performing at his top level is really important for the Brewers just to have some options. You know, right now, with guys like Loesch, Gomez, even Aramis Ramirez, the options are so limited because they're not performing well. And that makes it really difficult for Doug Melvin and his staff to decide what's the right thing to do for the future of this franchise when you don't really have a good baseline to start from. So it's that's, I think, why that at least plays into the decision to rest him a couple of days instead of having him continue to grind through it. Again, he can play, and he had been playing with this for a while, but it's a question of, do you let him play at a diminished capacity and try to win every game now, or do you back up a couple of days, try to get him as close as you can to 100% and get some better games out of him later? And they obviously have chosen the latter.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I think there's some pretty solid logic in that. Other news, the Brewers have already signed their first rounder, also a second and third rounder from the draft, just a smidge more than a week ago. So not wasting any time getting these guys in the system and beginning that development, which is always good.
Yeah, no, look, it's easy for me to say because it's not my money, but I always like when these picks sign early and want to get out and play. It's in their interest. And, you know, I've heard it from some club people before say, you sign now and you make your money later. And, you know, these guys are doing okay. The first rounder got $2.7 million to sign a contract to go play baseball. I think he's going to be all right for a little while. But it's, you know, the new system, this is one of the consequences that many more guys are signing early and getting out and playing ball. And I think it's a good thing for the teams, obviously, and I think it is a good thing for those players. As Ray Montgomery, their scouting director, said, in the case of Trent Clark, a nice left-handed hitter out of high school in Texas, it's an extra 250 solar bats that he's going to get this summer versus if he waits to sign and ends up not getting out to play this season. So that's, you know, really another full season under his books, another season closer to the big leagues. and he's a guy that they like. A lot of tools, center fielder to start, maybe eventually will move to right field. He's got a good arm, they say, and just a very natural hitter. It was very, I said this last week, I think, Dave, and it still stands out to me now. To hear a general manager talk about a draft pick who's 18 years old and just came out of high school as a professional-type hitter stands out. And that's the way you hear over and over and over about Trent Clark. He has a knack for getting the barrel of the bat to the baseball. And, hey, let him loose and see what he does in the minor leagues.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And, I think it helps individuals, helps the teams, but I think even better still, I just think it is really great for the game to get these guys going and see that youth, percolate up to the big leagues earlier. I just think it adds a whole lot of excitement. And I'll tell you another thing that adds excitement is Bob Uecker. And it's always great to have you healthy and happy and cracking wise. And
yeah.
But it's been one of those years, man, even for you, right? He gets locked in his booth. So lately he takes a ball off the old noggin, but he's okay. He's doing well.
Well, yeah. For those who didn't see it, a ball caromed off the cage during batting practice on Monday, and it hit Uecker on top of the head. He was joking about it with us afterwards, and he was fine. But they said he started to feel kind of off as the game went along. There's a joke to be made there about Uke feeling a little bit off. Thankfully, because he's all right, we can make that joke. But they took a look. He had a little concussion. And, he rested up, and hopefully we'll see him back at the ballpark. He has dialed back his travel schedule the past two seasons. He's 81 years old. He's a Hall of Famer. He deserves that, I think. I think everyone's happy to see him spending a little bit more time in the summers out on his boat. And so there's this road trip coming up, and he was going to have some downtime anyway. So, hey, if you're going to get conked on the head, here's a good time. You're already going to be out for a couple of days. Get him back and healthy because he's the most popular player in franchise history, and he never played for the team. So we want to get as many Bob Uecker games as we can, and hopefully he's feeling better today.
Yeah, again, you're spot on one more time, Adam, because he's a special dude, and that's good news on Uke. Well, listen, you brought a lot of good news this week. Maybe next week you'll have even more for us. We're looking forward to it, man.
All right, see ya.
Today, joined by the Cowboy, Jeff Brantley, filling in for Mark Sheldon, maybe Jeff just giving him kind of a little mental health break. I feel bad for Mark because each week we talk about these red struggles, what's going wrong, and you can only rehash that so many times in so many ways, and I know you have to do it on a nightly basis on TV and radio, but why don't you give us a little of your thoughts here on the podcast. What is it? What's going on with the Reds this year?
It has been a MASH unit. We thought last year was bad from an injury standpoint. It has only multiplied to be worse this year. I think after John Moscott hurting himself last night in his third major league start, and he's probably out for the rest of the year with a dislocated shoulder and Lord knows what else he did when he fell, trying to tag Anthony Gose here in Detroit. You look back and you think, wow, normally it's older guys that, veteran players that maybe with a hamstring or they get hurt because they've played for a long time. We lost Devin Mesoraco this year to a hip injury, of all things. And how tough it is for a catcher to squat with a hip injury. Well, that eliminated him from even having to get behind the plate. They tried him out in left field. That didn't work. We lost Homer Bailey last year to an injury in the forearm, a flexor mass tear, very similar to what Jonathan Broxton had a couple of years ago while playing for the Reds. And he comes back, pitches a couple of ball games, and now he's having to have Tommy John. So, you're looking at guys along your roster and you think, for this kind of club, especially being small market, really reserved in how they're going to spend their money, you can't afford to lose number one pitchers, number two pitchers. You can't afford to lose a starting player. And I didn't even mention Zach Cozart, who went down the other day. He had surgery on his left knee yesterday, basically total reconstruction. So this club has had its share of problems, not only from an injury standpoint, but the bullpen, timely hitting. I mean, you name it, it has gone wrong.
Yeah, it's it's one of those years, and it's funny because with Mark, it might have been the first or second podcast of the season. I said, boy, you know, they seem kind of chippy, the Reds. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you had the little, you know, the exchange with the Cardinals in that first series. Brian Price was ejected, or at least, had a couple of rhubarbs early on. And, of course, he had his blow up in the first month or so of the season. It just seems like there's been that extra edge all year along with all those things that you're talking about.
Well, I think the I don't know if you want to call it misconception or preconceived notion, however you want to describe it, but this club, I think for some reason, when the transition moved from Dusty Baker to Brian Price, I think there was an element of this club needs some fire underneath it, whether it be the position players, whether it be the starting pitching, the bull, whatever it may be. They need some fire in the clubhouse. There's always been a looming air of question about leadership on this club. Do they have enough fire? Can they go out there and play? And I think that's part of what you were seeing early in the season with the little bit of chip on the shoulder, kind of an edginess, as you described. But that turn, you know, when you start having your guys going down with injury, you forget about chippiness, you forget about edge, and you start trying to keep your head above water. And that's where the Reds are right now. I mean, they're just trying to keep from drowning.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you, though. I mean, they're, what, 7 games under? And given everything that has happened this year, I feel like every couple of weeks I look up and I think, hey, you know, it certainly hasn't been a great year. But the fact that they're as close as they are, a week or so away from 500, I think is almost remarkable given what they've had to go through.
It really is, Dave. You look at this club, I mean, it's got some quality players. I mean, we were in Chicago this past week, and it seemed like every top scout for every contending team was at the ballpark. Brian Sabian with the San Francisco Giants. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I've never seen him come to a ballpark to scout another team. He's the president. He's not even the general manager anymore, but he's at the ballpark. And obviously they're looking at either Mike Leake or Johnny Cueto. And there were tons of other scouts and different high-end personnel from all of these other clubs that were there to look at Cueto, Leake, and Aroldis Chapman for that matter. And, you know, that's one of the question marks that this club has now. I mean, Cincinnati's hosting the All-Star game, and all the questions that arise about player trades or, you know, changing teams, or are we going to rebuild this club? Is it time to do it? Have the injuries forced us into this position? Can we still contend with what we've got? I think those are all the questions that have come out. But I think that as an owner of the club, and I don't want to speak for Bob Castellini, but I wouldn't imagine that you would want to host the All-Star game and then turn around and see one of your players coming back to your ballpark wearing another team's uniform. I mean, that just, it just doesn't mesh. But at some point in time, when do you start the rebuild? And I think that's the huge question out there now for the Cincinnati Reds. I mean, when do you start to trade these pieces, the Leakes, the Cuetos, Aroldis Chapman, or do you just hold on to them and hope? I mean, there's two different sides of that equation, but all the baseball folks are saying, all right, when are you going to cut them loose?
Yeah, no, I think it's one of the biggies. And, you know, you figure, I know the thinking right now is with Mesoraco, you know, still a good chance that he comes back, good shape, ready to go next year. So that's almost like a huge acquisition. Maybe you add a piece in an offseason, you know, just survive the season, add a piece somewhere in there, hope for better health kind of thing. And, you know, and then it does turn around next year. But it's the great quandary, I think, for so many general managers is how to deal with this. And I guess on the positive side, Cowboy, I mean, you know, Frazier, in the middle of all this mess, has continued just to plug away and look really good at the plate.
Yeah, he really has. I mean, he's one of the true big right-handed power bats, I guess you could describe him, in the game. When he hits the ball, more times than not, if you elevate the pitch, he's going to hit it out of the ballpark. And you watch him time and time again. There were times last year when he first came up where I thought, boy, he's really chasing that breaking ball off the plate. Well, his discipline has gotten better. His study habits have gotten better. I think you're seeing a guy start to evolve as a true right-handed power hitter. We don't see too many of those types of guys around the game anymore. Matter of fact, teams pay big bucks for those kinds of players. And to watch Frazier not only be able to launch balls into the second and third deck, I mean, I'm talking about magnificent home runs, but he's starting to hit the ball in crucial times where you have to have just a base hit or you have to have a player just come up big in a certain spot. He's not only hitting the home runs and driving in runs, he's hitting for batting average as well. So, you know, that makes you feel good about keeping a guy like that as a cornerstone. And as you mentioned, with Mesoraco being able to come back next year and hopefully all of this hip issue will be beyond him and he'll be able to catch, it gives you a couple of young players that you know you can work with into the future, especially with some of the younger pitchers that we've had come to the big leagues this year. But the question mark is, okay, well, what do you do with Jay Bruce? Do you keep him for yet another year and hope that things continue to move in the right direction? He's starting to swing the bat better now. Brandon Phillips, you've got him no matter what. He's a 5-10 player. He's going to be at second base. And, of course, Frazier, you hope that Billy Hamilton is going to continue to evolve. And then if Marlon Byrd is not here left next year, then you've got a hole in left field. So you've got to be able to fill a couple of spots and answer some questions as well. And if you do end up trading Aroldis Chapman, you better find yourself a closer.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, he's a tough one for me to let go. Are you holding or are you trading at the deadline?
I think I would trade. If it was up to me, looking at all the injuries that this club has had, there are a couple of guys that I would move. I would move both Leak and Cueto. I think the big question for me right now is, do you really want to move Chapman if you think that this club can contend next year? And there are just few arms that come along in a big league lifetime. I'm not talking about just 10 or 12 years. I'm talking about forever that are like Aroldis Chapman. And he's just one of those special kinds of guys that, even though he may only pitch one, you know, two times in every 4 or 5 days, he's the kind of guy that you buy a ticket to come to the ballpark to watch and hope that he's coming in the ninth inning. That's how strong his presence is.
No doubt. And I think he changes the way managers manage a game beginning around the sixth and seventh inning. You have to be aware of his presence. I couldn't agree with you more. Well, Cowboy, always fun to catch up. Give Marty and the rest of the boys my love, and man, good luck. Just hang in there, brother, and we'll do it again sometime.
All right, take care. Great.
Well, there you go. That's this week on MLB.com Extras National League Central Edition.